Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the topic, the headline for today's show is simply contagion. Does the Brexit vote mean that we're going to have a Lehman Brothers moment? Remember Lehman Brothers? Yeah, the depth of the crash in 2008, the investment bank Lehman Brothers went under and everything fell apart. The global credit system froze up and we were on our way to, which was a kind of a depression that was a muted depression, or what I called an epic recession, to distinguish between normal recessions and bona fide depressions. Well, do we have a Lehman moment here? Well, I say no. I say what we have is a Bear Stearns moment. Okay, for those of you who don't know Bear Stearns, what is it? Well, what am I talking about, Bear Stearns? Well, Bear Stearns was another investment bank that in March of 2008 went under. Lehman Brothers did not collapse until September. So the crisis was already in progress, and it already took the economic life of a major institution called Bear Stearns. And it appeared after Bear Stearns crashed in March of 2008 that things had restabilized themselves, at least until July, when everything started going south again. So for about 3 months, it looked like the system was contained. The instability was contained. This is the way these financial crashes work. You see, they aren't simply a big explosion and down everything goes, and spiral ever after. No, these things move two steps forward, one step back, and often unpredictably. No one knows where the second foot's going to drop. And that's because financial assets are linked globally. All the different kinds of stocks and bond markets and currency markets and derivative markets and property markets, all these financial assets are linked. How are they linked? Well, because you have a global finance capital elite now, and they're the same people who are investing in these different kinds of financial assets globally. So if they're pulling in their horns on European government bonds or something like that, they are, insecure and uncertain as to where it's going to fall next. And they prepare to pull their investments on these other markets if they see any sign of contagion, the spread of the instability from the market that is already initially collapsing, like subprime loans, remember that, to other assets. That's why this contagion can move very quickly across financial markets and freeze them all up, which eventually happened in 2008. Well, we're at a point where we've had a shock, which they sometimes call a fat tail event, meaning they didn't see it coming. Or sometimes others call this a black swan event. Comes out of nowhere, you see. It only appears to come out of nowhere because the financial system is unstable. Fragile, as I call it. Fragility is the condition that makes a financial system or financial market or institution prone to financial instability and collapse. The more fragile a market or an institution is, the more likely it is to collapse, and it doesn't take much to push it over the cliff. Some kind of an event. Usually it appears to come out of nowhere, but in good times it wouldn't even been an event, a precipitating cause, you see. But because it's fragile, because the system is fragile now, it's on the brink, ready to contract, to collapse. When you have one of these events that otherwise would not have been an event, it becomes an excuse to collapse. Financial investors use it as a signal. Oh, time to take the money and run. and they've accumulated huge amounts of returns and profits since 2010. I've talked about this many times. And when they accumulate that much, and it doesn't look like they're accumulating as fast, or it's becoming harder and harder to accumulate even more profits, financial asset profits from speculation, they begin looking for the door. Oh, you know, gee, the stock market, just the Dow and the S&P 500 just keeps bouncing up and down here for 2 years now. It just can't seem to really, the Dow, to get going further than 18,000. You know, it drops 1,000, 1,500, then it comes back, and it pushes against that ceiling, and it can't really push through it. That's a signal. That churning at the top is a signal that it's not going any further, and so these professional investors start looking around and say, well, gee, well, maybe this is all we're going to get this round. Let's prepare to take our money and run. And they become very sensitive to events that they consider signals that, okay, the boom is over. Time to take your money, move it to the sidelines. And if this happens in more than one market, or many markets, financial markets, then that becomes an even stronger signal. You know, just one financial market, one stock market isn't enough. They've got to see this, you know, in multiple markets. And if they do, well, then they prepare, take their money and run. And they've been doing that step by step, you see. It's not a mad rush for the door, but they are preparing, and here and there they're pulling their money to the sidelines. Another event could occur here that could panic them in a more significant way, and you would have a mass herd rush for the door. There was an interesting interview here a couple of days ago with Larry Fink. Larry Fink is head of BlackRock, one of the biggest shadow banks in the world, asset management company, hedge fund / equity firm, all these shadow banks that I talk about a lot in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Financialization, I defined not simply as a percent of bank profits in the simplistic definitions that have occurred in the past, right? Financial fragility and financialization is defined by institutions, by agents, and markets altogether. The institutions are the global shadow banking system. And the global shadow banking system includes not just hedge funds and equity firms and asset management firms that, you know, you would obviously define as part of that, but the commercial banks have become shadow banks and part of their operation. And so have large multinational corporations who oftentimes make more money from their financial investments and arbitrage and so forth. They're part of the shadow banking system. Part of them is part of the shadow banking system. They may make real goods and services, but they also do this financial speculation. And then you have this new emerging online stuff. They call that fintech, financial tech. You know, LendingTree and so forth, Lending Club and these online things. That's what I call emerging shadow banks. The part of the financial functions within multinational corporations, you know, those are embedded shadow banks. And commercial banks like Chase and others who are partly finance speculators, those are called hybrid shadows. Well, anyway, that's in my chapter 12 in my book. If anyone's interested, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and from there you can go to my website and read some of the chapters. And I've actually put some chapters up of the book. But, you know, a lot of it is dedicated to how financial asset markets have changed and become dominant in the 21st century, and how financialization is really this combination of these shadow banks and all these new financial asset markets, very highly liquid markets that can be jumped in and jumped out, take your profit and run. And this network of very high net worth investors, about 200,000 of them global, I call this the new finance capital elite. Well, you know, The shadow banks are their preferred institutions for investing, and the markets are where they prefer to invest. So financialization is this whole institutional agent, finance capital elite, right, and market combination. The point is, it's that group out there is what drives financial asset prices. And we know financial asset prices, you know, stocks, bonds, derivatives, and so forth, commodity futures, including oil. We know this is what drives financial prices, and we know that financial prices, when they collapse too fast, you know, too widely, have a real negative effect on the real economy. How do they do it? Well, it gets transmitted through the banking system. You know, when you have all these financial asset markets collapsing, or investors pulling their money out and the prices of these financial assets collapse, it means big losses. Big losses for particularly commercial banks and other financial institutions that loan to real businesses that invest and make real things and hire real people, give them real wages and income, and you get a collapse of employment and wages and consumption, and there goes the real economy in consequence. So the financial asset markets in the 21st century have a big destabilizing effect on all the other markets and on the real economies. And where we are today is that the real economy is in deep trouble already. Global trade is almost stagnant, slowing down. Countries everywhere are trying to beggar their neighbor to get exports at the expense of somebody else because the global trade is slowing down, the growth in global trade. And they're all fighting with each other. That's what QE and monetary policy is about, drive down your currency. That's what internal devaluations are about, take it out on the working backs of the working class, drive down their wages and benefits so you can lower the price of your products so you can steal some exports from your other capitalist competitors. And everybody's engaging in this now because everything is slowing down globally. Real investment that creates real jobs is slowing down everywhere. It's at the lowest rate it's ever been. Well, you know, if you're not investing and expanding, you're not creating jobs and income and so forth. That's why one major reason why wages and income are stagnating. And because you're not really investing in real things very much anymore, it means productivity is collapsing. It's negative. We've never seen this before across all the global advanced economies. It's negative. Well, if it's negative, business isn't going to hire people, or they're only going to hire part-time temp contract people, which is going on. And you're not going to get wage recovery as a result. And you can, you know, tinker with minimum wages all you want, but the problem with wages is in the middle. It's just not growing, and real income is declining. And that's the problem with consumption. Well, consumption's barely going in the U.S. because of debt. And because people are spending their savings. And that can't go on, either of them, at some point. Okay, so to get back to Bear Stearns' analogy here, Brexit is a Bear Stearns event. It's a shot across the bow. It's a warning to the global capitalist economy because in good times, it would have had no effect whatsoever. In good economic times, but because the system is so fragile and growth is so poor, it's having an effect. Okay, so, well, yeah, it had a big effect on Thursday, Friday, right? But it seems it was recovered, hasn't it? Well, the stock markets, you know, went down 10-15%, but they're back up. Currencies collapsed, you know, the pound. And money rushed out of the pound and rushed into the dollar and the yen. Drove up the value of the dollar of the yen and the yen. Those are safe haven currencies. Well, when you drive up the value of the dollar, you drive up long-term interest rates. And the rising interest rates, long-term, not those that are influenced by the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve can only influence short-term rates. Long-term rates are driven by global economic conditions and money flows. Okay, so long-term rates and interest rates rise in the U.S. When that happens, emerging markets have a big problem. Money flows out of emerging markets, and it flows into the safety of the dollar or the yen. If it flows into the yen, it drives the value of the yen up and makes the recession in Japan even worse. See, Japan's in its fifth recession and depends a lot on exports. Well, if you drive up the value of the currency, the yen, it's going to make Japanese exports less competitive. So Japan has to respond with even pumping even more free money into the economy, which is having less and less effect, almost no effect now. Even, well, certainly it had, you know, all this liquidity by central banks had very little effect on the real economy from the very beginning. But it had some effect on boosting stock markets in those countries that introduced it, mostly Europe, U.S., U.K., most recently Japan and Europe, of course, still doing it, and doing it more and more and more. So it's had less and less effect on even driving down the currency and getting exports going or pumping the stock market. And the argument falsely was that, well, if you give investors and businesses big returns on financial assets, their stock price and so forth, they'll turn around and invest that in real expansion. Well, that never happened. A false argument never happened. And certainly, you know, the whole QE and the money injection by central banks has not produced much except to boost initially financial asset values, prices, and profits. But that's over. As they say, monetary policy is like pushing on a string. You know, it has no effect anymore. Even to boost stock prices and lower currencies. It's done. It's played out. And these, all over the world, these central banks have very little ammunition left to do anything, and they're saying, we can't do it anymore. You know, the head of the central bank of England here, Mark Carney, just this morning was talking and saying, you know, you guys are going to have to do something on fiscal stimulus. I'm going to make a big prediction here. I'm going to predict that you're going to see some fiscal stimulus packages beginning to come out in the advanced economies. We've already been seeing that in China. But you're going to see some fiscal stimulus in order to give cover for the central banks to raise their interest rates. You know, you raise the interest rates, you're going to cool off the economy. Well, you've got to stimulate the economy another way through fiscal spending, government spending, or tax cuts. They'll prefer tax cuts mostly. If you want to have a neutral effect, because the central banks are desperate to get their interest rates up. They're desperate to get it up because they're zero or worse. There is $12 trillion in negative government bond rates right now globally. Negative. In other words, if you want to buy these bonds, you got to pay the central bank to buy the bonds. It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. Negative rates. Since Brexit in 1 week, it's been almost $2 trillion more in negative rates added because the two most prominent effects of Brexit, financially, and market effects here, has been currency volatility, driving down the value of certain currencies, particularly the pound, euro to some extent, and conversely driving up as the money flows out and flows into the yen and the dollar, driving up the dollar. And, of course, you get consequent effects in emerging markets and the Chinese yuan. So currency volatility is a big thing here. And that hasn't really gone away. We're going to see a lot more volatility there. But the next immediate consequence in terms of markets is interest rates. And we see it particularly with UK interest rates for their bonds, their premier bonds called gilts, you know, dropping almost to zero now, and U.S. rates, lowest, the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond rates, the lowest ever. It's just a hair above 2%. It's going to go lower, I predict, over the intermediate term. You see, if you say, what are the effects of Brexit, you got to say, what's the immediate effect of Brexit? In other words, first couple of days or weeks. What's the intermediate effect, and what's the long-term effect? Well, we're still in the immediate, short-term effect here. And we saw this collapse of currencies and rates, you know, and then we stock markets follow. Currencies, interest rates, bond rates, and stock markets. Bond markets and stock markets. You know, watch these three and how they interact with each other in these different regions of the world. Well, everything's going south in the UK. And it's having negative effects on EU and other currencies in Europe, and positive effects driving up dollars and yens and pushing, depending on how much it goes up. The yen goes up in Asia will determine how much the yuan, the Chinese yuan, goes down. But it's at the bottom of its trading range. There's a band that China establishes, and it could break through that. And if it breaks through that, watch out. That could send us into a second phase of this. You see, if you go back to 2008, everything happened in phases and stages. It didn't just all plummet. And that's where we are right now. We're at the beginning of a process here. And the markets, you know, we're seeing more volatility, currencies, rates, stock and bond markets, first of all. And negative, deeper negative in Europe, Japan, approaching negative in the UK, and declining here in the U.S. as well. And it could stabilize for weeks, maybe even a couple months, right? All this volatility and uncertainty of where things are going has the intermediate effect on the real economy. Businesses who see this happening say, we don't know what the future is going to be. Let's stand pat. Let's not jump off a cliff here and increase our investment. So investment, real investment, you know, in plant, equipment, structures, and so forth, freezes up. So it's already been slowing down. By the way, I have a chapter just on the effects of real investment and financial investment in my book, Systemic Fragility. And I have chapters on what's happening with deflation, because if real investment is not occurring, then you're going to get deflation in real goods and services. And that's what's been happening. And that's going to translate both the deflation and investment, the real investment slowdown, into productivity declines. And that's been happening as well. See, there are long-term trends here, and there are short-term cyclical trends that overlay and exacerbate the long-term trends. Long-term investment, deflation, productivity have been occurring now for some time, you know, since 2000, but now they're being exacerbated. They were exacerbated by the crash in 2008-09, but they're being exacerbated again. And if you have productivity decline, businesses aren't, their labor costs are going to rise. That means they're not going to raise wages, and they're probably not going to hire. If they hire, they're going to hire part-time temp contract work, right? So jobs are affected intermediately. Wages are affected intermediately because this financial instability and financial asset declines translate into real investment slowing even further, which translates into deflation and productivity declines, and into bank lending slowing and freezing up. Now, let's take this bank lending thing. Where does that lead us? Well, if you look at the two weakest links, I think, in the global capitalist economy, in advanced economies, look at Italy and look at Japan, the two weakest links. Why Italy? Well, because you have $400 billion in non-performing bank loans in Italy. In other words, the Italian banks are almost insolvent, many of them. The companies they've loaned to cannot and are not repaying the principal and interest on those loans. So those become losses for the banks, and the banks need what's called recapitalization. Somebody needs to pump money back into them, or they got to get rid of the bad loans that are sitting on those banks' balance sheets, those $400 billion. One or both of the other. Well, Italy, the Renzi government, the center-left government there, liberals, whatever you want to call them, has been trying to deal with this. But they're not getting much cooperation and help from the Germans. You see, the Germans are doing fine. Germans dominate Europe economically, and they don't want to do much to bail out these other countries. We saw that, of course, with Greece, right? And I document in great detail the three Greek debt negotiations since 2010 in my forthcoming book, Looting Greece, an emerging new financial imperialism. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can read something about that book coming out here in August. So the Germans are at the heart of the problem here in Europe. German economy, meaning German banks. I don't mean German people. I mean the German bankers who are running the show over there in the EU, certainly in Germany. And they dominate the European Union, the common market, the Eurozone, the currency, the central bank, etc. All right, so they're not willing to give any assistance or help to Italy here. They said Merkel came out yesterday, I think it was, and said, no, sorry, we're not going to bail out your banks. You're going to have to set up a bad bank. What's a bad bank? A bank is a special institution that's set up that the government then takes the worst loans of the private banks and dumps them in a bad bank to get them off of the balance sheets of the private banks, so the private banks could hopefully, theoretically, lend again and get the economy going. So they set up this bad bank, and they're trying to offload the worst assets, Italy, Renzi government. And they've also set up this fund called the Atlas Fund, and $5 billion to buy up some of the bad assets from these banks. They're, you know, they're intermediate-sized banks, although UniCredit, a major bank in Italy, has been in trouble for some time. $5 billion. And the Renzi government asked the European Central Bank and the Germans, you know, can you help with this? And they said, no, use Atlas. The Atlas Fund, private investors, by the way, are Atlas funds. Debt buying, right? You know, you get private investors buy up these bad debts at a pennies on the dollar. And once everything stabilizes, these investors come back to the government and say, oh, the prices now, these bad debts have risen. We want you to make good the difference. You see, that's what happens typically. Argentina and so forth, you know, the vultures come in, they buy up the bad debt penny on dollar, and then they say, okay, pay us back the difference once things are better. They hold the government's ransom, and they usually get their way eventually. Now, this Atlas Fund has used up half of its $5 billion buying just one bank, the debt from just one little bank. So it's exhausted. The point being here, Italy is on a precipice. Italy is the danger point in the EU. And these banks and these non-performing loans in the EU, located predominantly in Italy, Italy could be the next Greece if things get worse. How are they going to bail out Italy, $400 billion? Well, they bailed out Greece for $275 billion. They could bail out Italy for $400 billion, and they will. Right? But it'll cause a crisis, a further crisis of confidence, and that will affect current currencies, stock markets, and interest rates, you see. And this negative interest rate, $12 trillion, is a time bomb. Time bomb sitting in the banking systems of the advanced economies of the world. Japan, North America, Europe. $12 trillion. Well, you know, I said a minute ago, Larry Fink, the head of the CEO of the biggest BlackRock, you know, one of the biggest shadow banks, you know, was interviewed recently, and he admitted there's $55 trillion sitting on the sidelines out there. The capitalist financial speculators have pulled their money, and they're sitting, and they're going to pull some more if it gets worse. You know, my book, I estimated that the shadow banks had about $75 trillion globally. So it's not too far from Larry Fink's estimate of $55 trillion. By the way, it's just about the same as the total amount of additional debt that has been pumped into the global economy since 2010. You know, debt was a big problem. Private debt, corporate debt, financial bank debt. That's what the problem in 2008 was all about. Not the government debt. Government debt rises because of the consequence of the implosion of the private sector debt. They have to bail out the banks, right? They have to bail out investors. They have to bail out non-bank companies that get in trouble because of the crash. And, of course, in bailing them out with financial and policy and no fiscal policy, austerity means no fiscal policy, in doing that, the economies don't really recover. So their deficits rise, and governments add even more debt. You know, what's the debt picture in the United States? Well, the federal government debt's about $19 trillion. $19 trillion, $18, $19 trillion. Oh, but that's just the federal government debt. You see, that's not counting state and local debt. We don't know exactly how much that is. Let's be very conservative and say another $6 trillion. All right, so government debt's about $25 trillion in the U.S. What about household debt? Household debt is about $13 trillion. What about non-financial corporate debt? That's about $14 trillion. And what about financial debt in the U.S.? We don't know exactly, but I'd say that's probably at least $20 trillion. So if you look at $13 trillion, $14 trillion, $27 trillion, another $20 trillion financial debt, you know, that's almost $50 trillion in private sector debt, which dwarfs the $19 trillion in government debt. Now, the problem with debt is it's got to be repaid no matter what happens to the economy. But if the economy turns south and you're in a recession, both banks and businesses and consumers don't have the income to pay the principal and interest that comes due on the debt. What they then are faced with is either someone bails them out, the government, and essentially the government takes the private sector debt, puts it on its own balance sheet, and adds it to government debt, which occurs, right? Or if you don't get bailed out, and households don't get bailed out, if you don't get bailed out, then you default. You don't make a payment, and somebody takes over your asset. And in doing so, they then try to sell your asset, and the price collapses even more, and it drags down financial prices across markets even more. You're going deeper into the problem, you see. Defaults create a deeper problem here. But defaults are a function not only of excess debt that's built up, $70 trillion in the U.S., right, over the years, globally, $55 trillion just since 2010. That's, by the way, according to the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, the bank for the central bankers globally. All right, so we have this massive debt buildup everywhere, you know, and we're just sort of struggling along, paying the debt, you know, principal and interest on it, as long as things don't crash. But if things crash in the real economy, the income to pay for it crashes, and now you've got a problem. It's not just the total amount of debt the rate increase of the debt, yes, that's part of the problem, but how can you pay the debt when times go bad and prices collapse? You see, when prices collapse, your income collapses, and your ability to pay the debt, therefore, collapses. And when recession sets in, you know, your income collapses again, and you can't pay the debt. You either roll the debt over, or someone bails you out, or you default, and everything gets worse. Well, that's what happened with Lehman Brothers. You know, and I'm saying Brexit was a Bear Stearns event. Let's see what happens over the next 6 months, and even longer, you see. That's important. We still don't know what the effect of Brexit and this loss of confidence is going to be on the global economy and oil, commodity prices, and so forth. Certainly, there's going to be a recession in the UK, right? All right, we've been looking at markets so far. What's the contagion effect of Brexit on markets? And we talked about currencies. Just to sum up here, stock and bond rates, I mean, interest rates, bond rates, stock and bond markets, right? On real investment, on productivity, on bank lending, okay? Oil and commodity prices, well, they're linked to U.S. interest rates and the rise of the dollar significantly, you know. In the U.S., there's not going to be any short-term rates by the Fed now, probably throughout all of next year, some say. Certainly not for the rest of the year. That's off the table. And we'll see in the next couple of months how much U.S. GDP really recovered in this second quarter compared to the very, very poor performance in the first quarter, which, according to my calculations, was significantly less than 1.1%, which the official estimate is. I would say U.S. economy probably grew no more than 0.5% in the first quarter. Certainly quarter to quarter, you see, because the U.S. Numbers are, for the quarter in question, GDP numbers, compared to the year previous quarter. It's not, you know, 1.1% compared to the fourth quarter of 2015. No, it's 1.1 compared to the first quarter of 2015. That's the way the U.S. calculates its GDP. Kind of goofy, but it does. So we don't know what the effect is going to be on emerging markets. Certainly their currencies are going to decline and the capital flight is going to increase. They will probably respond by raising interest rates, which means deeper recessions in emerging markets in places like Latin America. Certainly there's going to be a recession in the U.K., as I said a second ago. Why? Because everything's freezing up in the U.K., not only economically, but politically as well. Now, this is the swan song for the British economy here. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, let's look at the economy and the political scene in the U.K. and throughout the European market. Right. Well, UK is going to be recession. Everyone says it's going to be recession. Well, why so? Because everything's freezing up, you see. No one knows what the future's going to bring. Simply because they took this vote, Brexit, right, doesn't mean that they're going to leave right away. What you got, as I said before, is Britain's Parliament has to vote to exit and then has to activate Article 50 of the EU Constitution, which sets in process the whole exit negotiations. Then they have to negotiate. Well, no one in Britain, political parties, wants to touch the hot potato. Cameron didn't, you know, he didn't want to negotiate this. He resigned, which means there'll be new elections in the UK in October. And whoever is elected will then have to formulate a plan sometime, you know, in the remainder of the year on how they're going to approach negotiations with the EU representatives for exiting. But that means they won't start real negotiations till next January. Well, that's too close to elections in France and Germany. So they're not going to want to sit down and seriously negotiate, and certainly not rush the judgment before their elections. So you're going to have to wait for French and German and I think also Netherlands elections in the spring of next year. And then it's going to take a couple more months to everyone get their act together. So you're not going to see even the beginning of negotiations for another 12 to 18 months, closer to 18. And according to the treaty, Article 50, there's a two-year window. From the time that Britain says, okay, let's begin negotiations, which won't happen until later this year, so that's the end of 2016, for 2 years between the end of 2016 this year and 2018, uncertainty is the key word for Britain and its economy, uncertainty. And if there's uncertainty, there's not going to be investment, you see. It's pretty clear that some of this talk about, oh, let's have another referendum, is not going to happen. Well, there's going to be a Brexit, apparently. But that could change if the UK new regime that comes in, that could change, but not likely. You know, there will be some sort of Brexit of some sort, which means uncertainty for two more years. Uncertainty means no investment for two more years, and it means you're going to see the financial center in Britain, global financial center called the City of London, sort of fray at the edges. Right? It's going to start coming apart at the edges. Some of these banks and financial institutions that are in London, because London is the global trading center for the euro currency and was about to be and sort of is the global trading center for the Chinese yuan, both of those are now not likely. The euro trading, currency trading, is going to move back to probably Frankfurt. Right? And asset management, in other words, rich people's money, where you're going to put it, banks and asset management companies, shadow banks, are probably going to move to Paris. Or, you know, there's even some talk of moving to Geneva or even Dublin. I doubt it'll be Dublin. Well, there may be some. Anyway, it's going to be, you know, it's going to fray at the edges there. And that's the major economy left for Britain. Financial services and related professional services. It doesn't have much of other things. You see, Britain runs what's called a negative current account deficit, trade deficit, with everybody else. You know, Britain imports about 25% more than it exports. It has a negative trade balance, which means money flows have to come in, investment has to come in to the UK to offset those flows, or else the pound, the currency, will decline even more. And that's going to happen. I don't see the money flows coming in as the way they used to come in with the banking system in question in the City of London. And you're going to see even a greater current account or trade deficit emerging. And that imbalance is going to grow between exports of goods and imports of money. And that means the pound is going to decline even more. The pound is on its way out as a global trading currency. Major implications of that. And we'll see what happens as a result of that. Okay, politically, what's going on in the UK? Well, politically, there's a lot of instability, you know. Boris Johnson, who everyone thought was going to be the new candidate for the Tory party, said, I'm not running. So the Tories are infighting with each other. Why? Because no one wants to take the hot potato of these negotiations and be blamed for the recession that's coming on their watch, you see? So, you know, the Tory party is, you know, they're passing the hot potato around. I don't want it. I don't want it, kind of thing. Another important consequence politically in the UK is the attack on the head of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn recently arose as a result of a rebellion in the ranks of the Labour Party against the parliamentary wing, which is pro-business and out of touch, you know, the Blair, Tony Blair, and, you know, all the mildew residue from Blair is sitting in the MPs, members of parliament, in the Labour Party. And the Tony Blair meant the destruction of the Labour Party as a social democratic party. And the parliamentary party is still very much in that view, a Blairite view, an anti-social democracy view, which is destroying it. So there was an upsurge, a rebellion of people in England, Scotland, Wales, who want a restoration of the Labour Party to its origins. And that's where Corbyn came in less than a year ago. Okay, so this whole Brexit event has served as a pretext, an excuse for the parliamentary conservatives in the Labour Party, pro-corporate wing, to attack Corbyn and demand that Corbyn resign. I mean, Corbyn wasn't the head of the government. Well, our argument is, well, he didn't fight strong enough to remain in this Brexit vote. It's a very veiled, thin excuse to try for the pro-corporate people in the Labour Party to try to attack and stop this rebellion from below. Kind of like a Sanders thing, you know? So we've got the situation in which the Labour Party members of Parliament, by clear majority, said, resign, Jeremy, resign. And he won't resign, though, because he feels he has grassroots support. So we got a big split going on in the Labour Party, just as we have splits in the Conservative Party, the Tory Party. And what that means is that indecision. You see, this is all the political contagion and fallout. And then we got Scotland, the National Scottish Party, saying, oh, you know, if Britain leaves, we may want to leave Britain so we can stay in the EU. Well, that's not going to happen, you see, because Spain would not allow Scotland to remain in the European Union, because if they do that, that's an acknowledgement that Catalonia, you know, Spanish province, could separate from Spain and yet stay in the EU, you know, so they will veto that. It only takes one country to veto these kind of decisions. So forget it, Scotland. You know, you're not going to be able, even if you take a second vote, you're not going to be able to second vote to leave the United Kingdom, you're not going to be able to remain in the EU. Okay, what about in France? Well, a lot of upheaval going on in France as well. François Hollande, you know, head of the Socialist Party, another social democratic party that has abandoned its roots and serving corporate interests and neoliberal interests, you know, attacking its own working class and unions. A real challenge arising. They're going to have a primary, equivalent primary elections to determine who the Socialist Party candidate is going to be in the national elections in France in the spring. And this guy Macron, coming out of nowhere, appealing once again, like Corbyn, to the social democratic roots, just as Sanders appealed to the Democratic Party roots. But I predict the National Front will win a plurality in the French elections, and then talk about uncertainty. Same fight going on in the Netherlands. This Wilders guy of the Freedom Party there, rising on the wake of this Brexit, as more and more smaller areas and countries are considering leaving, and that, by the way, includes Denmark and Scandinavia. You know, with Britain out, Denmark and Scandinavia was going to be very uncertain about whether they want to remain in the EU, the European Union, see? And then in Italy, we have all this instability, as I talk about the banking system and the economic system, and the head, the minister there, Renzi, of Italy, trying to push through political reforms. There's going to be a referendum there on political reforms. And we see the increasing popularity of what's called the Five-Star Movement, another political party like Podemos in Spain, and Die Linke in Germany, you know, National Front, Syriza, Scottish National Parties. All of these arising challenges from the left and the right is occurring because neoliberalism and those parties are messing up the whole European experiment. And the social democratic parties have thrown in, the traditional ones, have thrown in their lot with neoliberalism in Europe. You know, the SPD in Germany and the junior partner in Germany, neoliberalism. Socialist Party doing the bidding of the neoliberal project there, attacking labor market reforms, which means attack the unions and wages and so forth. You know, get rid of, make it easy for companies to fire people, get rid of national collective bargaining issues, undermine the unions, get rid of the labor courts where people laid off can protest their layoffs in France. Yes, sounds strange, right, compared to us here in the U.S. You get laid off in France and the company was doing well, you have a basis of challenging the layoff, getting your job back. And you know, workers were able to win more than they were able to lose through that medium. So they want to get rid of that, right? And they want to get rid of the 35-hour work week. Anyway, all of that political instability there. Then, of course, we see the political implications of Brexit and European instability on the U.S. here, right? What did Trump do? He ran off to Scotland, ran off to the U.K., and came out with a strong statement against free trade again. It's interesting to see, you know, what's the U.S. response? Oh, you know, Obama and all the rest, you know, were free traders, of course, came out with warnings, not only against Trump, but against Hillary. Don't take this free trade thing too far, folks. And then quickly, Obama meets with Nieto there, the president of Mexico, and the prime minister, Trudeau, of Canada, and all three of them, you know, become three amigos, right? All for free trade. You know, they know the fight's coming here, so they're closing ranks, and here comes the big propaganda offensive for free trade, right? Three amigos. Okay. So it's injected itself into the U.S. campaign, political campaign. The EU, of course, politically, the devolution, in other words, the splitting up forces are growing. Scotland, Catalonia, the Netherlands, right? Different parts of other countries, Denmark, Scandinavia, independent nationalism, you know, in Poland and Hungary, and so forth. The whole idea of closer integration, which is some are saying, oh, now we got to reform the EU and more political integration, never going to happen because East Europeans and Germans don't want it. Germany loves this arrangement. It's profiting, you know, greatly from the half-ass organization called the European Union and the Eurozone. Okay, so political instability, political. And no one knows how all this is going to affect Japan, by the way. You know, Japan is the basket case of the advanced global economies, and now this thing is affecting its exchange rates, driving up the yen, and Abenomics, as they call it, after Shinzo Abe, the prime minister there, has completely failed, and they've recognized that it's failed, even though, you know, they're pumping almost $100 billion a month. That's a month into the Japanese economy, and the money's just flowing right out, right? So we have this great instability politically across the global economy, particularly advanced economies. Of course, we know instability has been intensifying throughout Latin America and other places, you know, Nigeria, Indonesia, so forth. Japan is a strange culture, political culture, And we don't see the political upheaval there. We have a party that's dominated for some time and not much of a challenge to it. But Japan, economically, is in deep problems, and doesn't seem to have a solution at all. The monetary solution, central bank solution, more money is not working. They cannot get wages up, and they cannot fiscally stimulate the economy, even though they say they are. And Japan's, as I said, is in its fifth recession, and it's probably going to go deeper now. Okay. And in the U.S., we see the penetration of the contagion politically into the campaigns, and we will see the effects economically through the currency exchange rates and interest rates, particularly federal bond rates, which are rapidly declining. Well, slowing down. They're not negative territory yet, but they are the growth. We're at 2.1, 2.2 for a 30-year bond. Incredible. What, 1.4 for the 10-year bond? Something like that. I predict for years over, it's going to be less than one. In other words, we're on the same trajectory of negative rates that Japan and Europe are already deep into, to the tune of $12 trillion, and the U.K. is about to enter into as well. Rates are falling even faster there. And nobody's borrowing the money. Super, super low rates, and no one's borrowing the money for a whole number of reasons I explain in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Now, it's interesting, too, where Britain, Brexit, in earlier this spring shows, I talked about a Greek exit, right, and how the IMF was resurrecting the issue of Greek debt here to get it put to bed for another year instead of waiting until July. Well, as I said, they were uncertain about what the effects of Brexit would be, and they wanted to get Grexit off the table, which they've done for another year. But the whole Greek thing is going to blow up again. There's no way. You know, it's sort of stable this year because not a lot has... not a lot of debt payments are due this year, but next year is a different question. We will see Grexit on the table once again. And now that Britain has left, the Greek exit becomes a possibility. Okay, that's our review of Contagion and the Bear Stearns Revisited Brexit event. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Vision.